Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and on today's show, we're going to be reading from the June 2025 issue of The Atlantic magazine, and we read the feature articles on this show along with other articles from other magazines. So let's get started. This first article is headlined, "Is This the First Ever Era of American Pop Culture? An Emerging Critical Consensus Argues That We've Entered a Cultural Dark Age." I'm not so sure. It's by Spencer Kornhaber. Last year, I visited the music historian Ted Gioia to talk about the death of civilization. He welcomed me into his suburban Texas home and showed me a sunlit library. At the center of the room, arranged neatly on a countertop, stood 41 books. These, he said, were the books I needed to read. The display included all 7 volumes of Edward Gibbon's 18th century opus, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, both volumes of Oswald Spengler's World War I era tract, The Decline of the West, and a 25-year-old account of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, who was the first historian to look at his own culture, Greece, and say, "I'm going to tell you the story of how stupid we were," Gioia explained. Gioia's contribution to this lineage of doomslaying had made him into something of an internet celebrity. For most of his career, he was best known for writing about jazz, but with his Substack newsletter, The Honest Broker, he's attracted a large and avid readership by taking on contemporary culture and arguing that it's terrible. "America's creative energy has been sapped," he told me, "and the results can be seen in the diminished quality of arts and entertainment, with knock-on effects to the country's happiness and even its political stability." He's not alone in fearing that we've entered a cultural dark age. According to a recent YouGov poll, Americans rate the 2020s as the worst decade in a century for music, movies, fashion, TV, and sports. A 2023 story in the New York Times Magazine declared that we're in the least innovative, least transformative, least pioneering century for cultural since the invention of the printing press. An art critic for The Guardian recently proclaimed that the avant-garde is dead. What's so jarring about these declarations of malaise is that we should, logically, be in a renaissance. The internet has caused a Cambrian explosion of creative expression by allowing artists to execute and distribute their visions with unprecedented ease. More than 500 scripted TV shows get made every year. Streaming services reportedly add about 100,000 songs every day. We have podcasts that cater to every niche passion and video games of novelistic sophistication. Technology companies like to say that they've democratized the arts, enabling exciting collisions of ideas from unlikely talents. Yet no one seems very happy about the results. To a certain extent, such negativity may simply reflect on an inane human tendency to fret about decline. Some of the most liberating developments in history have first triggered fears of social stultification. The advent of the printing press caused 15th century thinkers to complain of mass distraction. In 1964, The Atlantic published an essay predicting, not unpersuasively, that the rock and roll would only foster conformity and consumerism in young Americans. For as long as I've been a critic at this magazine, I've tried to cut against the declinist impulse. The year I started the job in 2011 was a turning point of sorts. Spotify launched in America that July. Netflix debuted its first original series soon after. The brainy rock bands I'd grown up loving, Radiohead and Wilco, were starting to fade in importance, but pop, hip-hop, and electronic music were cross-pollinating in fascinating ways. Understanding change and appreciating how human creativity flourishes anew in each era always seemed the point of the job. Yet in the 2020s have tested my optimism. The chaos of TikTok, the disruption of the pandemic, and the threat of AI have destabilized any coherent story of progress driving the arts forward. In its place, a narrative of decay has taken hold, evangelized by critics such as Giora. They're citing very real problems: Hollywood's regurgitation of intellectual property, partisan culture wars hijacking actual culture, unsustainable economic conditions for artists, the addicting, distracting effects of modern technology. I wanted to meet with some of the most articulate pessimists to test the validity of their ideas and to see whether a story other than decline might yet be told. Previous periods of change have yielded great artistic breakthroughs. Industrialization begat romanticism. World War I awakened the modernist. Either something similar is happening right now, or we're not yet able to see it, or we really have at least slid into the wasteland. In 312 CE, the Roman Senate ordered the construction of a gaudy monument called the Arch of Constantine. It incorporated pieces from older monuments built in more glorious times for the empire, which had begun its century-long decline. The arch is one of Gioria's favorite metaphors for modern culture. The TV and film industry is a moored of reboots, spin-offs, and formulaic genre fare. Broadway theaters subsist on stunt cast revivals of old war horses. Book publishers rely disproportionately on backlist sales. Entertainment companies have long understood the power of giving people more of what they already like, but recommendation algorithms take that logic to a new extreme, keeping us swiping endlessly for slight variations on our favorite things. In every sector of society, Gioria told me, we're facing powerful forces that want to impose stagnation on us. The problem is particularly acute in music. In 2024, new releases accounted for little more than a quarter of the albums consumed in the U.S. Every year, a greater and greater percentage of the albums streamed online is catalog music, meaning it is at least 18 months old. Hoping to remonetize the classics, record labels and private equity firms have spent billions of dollars to acquire artists' publishing rights. The reemergence of Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill on the Billboard Hot 100 in 2022, 37 years after its release, seemed to signal that this was a good bet. A brief placement in a popular TV show, Netflix's Stranger Things itself, is a past of 1980s movie tropes, could, it turned out, curse an old hit to outcompete the most of the newer songs in the world. Music is turning into a rights-based management business, Giora said. There are vested interests now that don't want new music to flourish. The private equity funds that just want you to listen to the same songs over and over again because they own them. The ultimate effect, he thinks, is to discourage true, daring artistry. If Bach were alive today, he'd spend a few weeks trying to break into the LA music scene and say, I'll be a hedge fund manager instead. Gioria, 67, knows something about greatness thwarted. He started his career as a consultant working for Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey, but he moonlighted as a jazz pianist, releasing two albums and gigging around the world. At one point in our conversation, he pulled up a recording of himself playing piano in 1986 before he suffered a debilitating case of arthritis in his 30s. "These arpeggios, I can't do this anymore," he said. "I always felt that if you give me another 9, 12, 18 months, I could be as good as anybody in the world." Gioia's background is both a quant gives his criticism its distinctive edge. He's able to deliver clear, hard-headed analysis of an art form frequently discussed in soft abstractions. "I've often found myself swept away by the force of his convictions. Still, I nurse some doubts about his claim that the arts are frozen in amber." In a viral 2022 Substack post titled, "Is Old Music Killing New Music?" later republished by The Atlantic, Gioia described omens of stagnation in everyday life, such as when he encountered a youngster singing along to The Police's "Message in a Bottle." "The example stung a bit. The Police broke up before I was born, yet I've been humming their songs my whole life. Of course, when I was listening to my parents' records in the 90s, no one was measuring the replaying of old music. Today, by contrast, every Spotify play is monitored and monetized." So might Gioia be over-interpreting data showing listening habits that have long existed? He didn't think so. "In my generation," he said, "nobody I know listened to their parents' music." Gioia's generation is the baby boomers, which more than any since convinced of itself as revolutionary. The rock and roll movement gave boomers a fresh, elders-offending sound to call their own, and as they age, they witness other breakthroughs: punk, hip-hop, electronic music. Gioia's asked me to compare that dynamism with what's happened, or rather not happened, in the 21st century. "The music today doesn't sound that much different from 20 years ago," Gioia said. I turn that assertion over in my mind. The radio does play new music that feels old, such as Sabrina Carpenter's disco bop Espresso and Benson Boone's classic rock-flavored anthem Beautiful Things, but it also plays musicians who seem firmly planted in the present. Billie Eilish's blend of jazz and electronic music diverges from the work of any pop star before her. Shaboozey combines country music and rap in a way that perhaps for the first time in history doesn't feel like a joke. Reggaeton, Afrobeats, and K-pop now reach English-speaking audiences to an extent that was unthinkable when traditional gatekeepers, major labels, drive-time DJs, Rolling Stones held more sway. These developments may not quite as paradigm-shifting as rock and roll was, but they do suggest a culture that is still actively evolving. Gioia acknowledged that some bright spots for culture, he's not entirely fatalistic about the status quo. He tends to view culture as moving in predictable cycles. When malaise and mediocrity reach an extreme, a revolution is likely to mount, upending the old order and installing a new one. Most people fundamentally want to have cultural experiences that are mind-expanding and broaden their world, he said. If the corporation that controls our culture refuses to deliver that, they will find a way around it, and there will be a rebirth. We will have a new counterculture, he predicted, a wave of new romanticism, emphasizing humanity over technology, and new maximalism, art made with unbridled ambition. Gioia himself is trying to help bring a revolution about, albeit in small ways. Every day, he listens to hours of new music, searching for gems that our algorithms have ignored. He showed me a draft of a post recommending 9 new albums to his Substack readers. The lead image was that of a young woman in a bonnet and stockings sitting on a bed strewn with stuffed animals. This was Mi Simons, who sings dreamy bossa nova songs in English and Japanese. Jorian noted that 3 weeks after the album's release, she had only 8,700 plays on YouTube. "I sometimes recommend albums that have less than 100 views," he said. To Joria, the low listenership was evidence of the record industry's efforts to smother new talents. But as I sat watching him pull up exciting find after exciting find, I started to feel oddly reassured about society's creative energy. Today's corporate behemoths may be powerful and very often craven, but they're reckoning with a force more destabilizing than Sgt. Pepper's and London Calling ever were, a fractured global audience using technology to chase their obsessions, both familiar and novel. Joria went to YouTube and loaded another video of the Australian band Glass Beams. Its members wear jewel masks over their faces while playing intricate surf rock grooves. "This band is great, and nobody's heard it," he said. "How many plays has it got?" He scrolled down to the answer. "Nearly 1 million, Joria winced. "So it's not as big a secret as I was making it out to be," he said. A few months later, I revisited the same video and saw the play count had reached more than 6 million. The top comment read, "Praise to the algorithms for this." Cynicism. The title of the show was Transcendence. On the second floor of the prestigious Pace Gallery in Manhattan hung white-on-white abstract paintings and what appeared to be line drawings of rocks. Wall text explained that this was the first ever U.S. solo exhibition for the 79-year-old artist Hong Dunith. One painting was inspired by the first snowfall he ever witnessed as a child after the first Indonesia war forced her family to move from Vietnam to France in 1953. The art critic Dean Kissick, wearing a baggy pink polo shirt and short athletic shorts, rushed through the room, barely glancing at the art. "I don't think I can do this," he whispered to me, stifling a giggle. Kissick, 42, is a writer known in large part for his annoyance at the state of the art world. He believes we've been stuck in the long 2017, a period in which anxieties related to Donald Trump and Brexit have smothered culture with moralism, navel-gazing, and conformity. Although transcendence, achieved through beauty, originality, and skill, should be the primary goal, art has become much more about messaging, raising awareness, or a kind of ambient healing of the world, he told me. In other words, whereas Joria waits a revolution, Kissick thinks we've recently lived through one, and it's made everything drearier. We'd met up so Kissick could take me on a tour of the gallery scene in Chelsea. The Donith show, he explained, demonstrated a typical tactic among dealers these days. Find a relatively obscure figure from an underrepresented group and try to sell his or her work, at least in part, on the basis of identity. The blander the art, the better for serving rich people looking to furnish tastefully understated homes. "This is just like sofas," he said, gesturing towards Dada's soothingly serene canvas curtains. We stepped into an elevator, and I asked him whether he at least felt a sense of justice at seeing someone like Donith exhibited at one of the world's most exclusive galleries in the world. "I always like to see older Asian women doing well because they remind me of my mother," said Kissick, whose mother is a Japanese immigrant to the UK. "But no, I don't see justice." Last year, Kissick published a cover story in Harper's arguing that politics had all but destroyed contemporary art. Museum and galleries were blending all forms of oppression into one universal grief, he wrote. "We are bombarded with identities until they become meaningless, when everyone's tossed together into the big salad of marginalization, otherness is made banal and abstract." the essay opened with a shocking scene. In May 2024, on her way to see a show at London's Barbican Art Gallery, Kissick's mother was struck by a bus, an accident that resulted in the amputation of both her legs. Kissick flew from New York to London to visit her in the hospital. Later, as she recuperated, he checked out the show he'd been on his way to see. Titled Unravel, it featured textile art, primarily by artists from historically marginalized communities. As Kissick noted, the curators further proposed that textiles themselves had also been marginalized, having been gendered as feminine, regarded as craft rather than fine art. The show's introductory text asked, "What does it mean to imagine a needle, a loom, or a garment as a tool of resistance?" Kissick's assessment was withering. "It was the most depressing exhibition I'd ever seen at the gallery, hardly worth a visit, let alone losing one's legs." While Unravel pretended to be political radical, even revolutionary, it didn't seem to stand for much beyond liberal orthodoxy and feel-good ambient diversity. It offered fantasies of resistance, but had little to offer in terms of genuine, substantive social change or artistic experimentation. Critiquing progressive in fashion may simply sound conservative. Indeed, Kissick's complaints are now reflected in the anti-DEI wave that has swept the federal government and ripped through the American corporate, cultural, and academic institutions. But Kissick insists he's not ideologically motivated. "I just don't care that much if people are very woke or very anti-woke," he told me. "The conversation itself just takes up way too much space." The conversation has been impossible to avoid in pop culture as it has been in high culture. Proponents of the theory that representation matters, meaning that more inclusive media will create a more inclusive society, have cheered diversity cast remakes on films such as The Little Mermaid, body positive choruses sung by artists like Lizzo, and reckonings with perceived cultural appropriation in the literary world. Conservatives, in turn, have organized a backlash, attempting to score ideological points by racking up streams and downloads. When Jason Aldean's 2023 song, "Try That in a Small Town," was criticized by some on the left for tacitly endorsing lynching, a right-wing campaign to support the track resulted in Aldean's hitting number one on the top 100. Similar campaigns boosted the box office prominence of films such as the anti-DEI mockumentary, "Am I Racist?" Even the most escapist forms of entertainment, blockbusters, pop concerts, children's TV, are now treated like political battlegrounds, though you rarely hear about anyone's opinions being changed in the skirmishes. In the world of fine art, Kissick feels overwhelmed by what he sees as cynicism masquerading as idealism. He mentioned the example of Amoko Bafo, an in-demand Ghanaian painter who was hired to adorn the nose cone of one of Jeff Bezos' rockets in 2021. At the time, a statement by Blue Origin, Bezos' spaceflight company, announced, "His stunning portraits carry black joy and the kind of shared future we hope to create for us all in space, vibrant, beautiful, and full of wonder." One could be forgiven, however, for thinking the commission was motivated less by black joy than by PR concerns around a controversial billionaire's vanity project. One could likewise be forgiven, judging by Bezos' action since Trump's re-election, for wondering whether future nose cones will be similarly adorned. To some extent, I sympathize with Kissick's complaints. Mediocre art really does not get overrated on account of its politics. Any working critic knows how factional and reflective audiences have become. Pan a woman and many readers will call you sexist. Champion one and you'll risk being dismissed as a beta cuck. Such reactions don't just represent the persistence of prejudice. They reflect an awareness of the way the culture, a supposedly blinding force, has come to feel more and more like an embittered sports rivalry. But any working critic will also tell you that topically and identity have inspired incredible work in previous eras. Just listen to Nina Simone. And recently, watch the post hashtag MeToo masterpiece Tar, about a lesbian orchestra conductor accused of misconduct. Even Kissick acknowledges this. He gushed to me about the artist Arthur Jaffa's 2021 video installation, Aghedra. Its depiction of an ominous, undulating seascape evokes, as the artist told Art News, the feeling of being chained in a slave ship. Kissick even had kind words for Salman Tor, a much hyped Pakistani artist based in New York who makes green-gray impressionistic smudges of queer guys hanging out in bars or apartments. Tor's typifies one of Kissick's least favorite pairings, old-school technique with a 21st-century identity-related twist. But at least Kissick said he can really paint. As we hustled from gallery to gallery, popping in for mere minutes and then leaving, I began to get the sense that Kislik's grudge against art world goes deeper than politics. He deemed a colorful painting of the motocross riders rubbish, a huge haunting sculpture of a half-dressed woman with blurred features, as it rendered by rudimentary CGI, received just a murmured cool. At one point, he acknowledged his jadedness. You can probably tell I've seen too many white cube shows of paintings in my life. There's too much art. The problem, if it can be called one, has escalated since around the time of Kissick's graduated from art school in 2010. Back then, he felt visual art was crossing over to become a mainstream cultural phenomenon. Jay-Z was rapping about collecting Bequests, and Louis Vuitton was making handbags with the Japanese visual artist Toshiki Mukakami. The internet, it appeared, was encouraging audiences beyond the walls of galleries and museums to develop an interest in art. But hope for technologically enabled creative flourishing gave way to oversaturation and numbness. So-called zombie formalism, rehatched abstract expressionism optimized for Instagram shareability became a fad. Minimalism, a presumed antidote for the chaos of online life, became the default aesthetic in art, fashion, and consumer product design. It's been clear for a while that art's running out of ideas, Kissick declared in a 2021 column for The Spectator. The overvaluing of stale, activism-centered art is a symptom of all this burnout. If stylistic innovation can no longer break through the noise, we're only left to argue over subject matter. What would a better direction be? Kissick's cagey on this question, but he has a few ideas. Art should capture its era, he said, but the culture wars are not the only important thing about the 2020s. Rather, he wants art to address the internet's more effable consequences, rendering our thought processes glitchy, destabilizing our sense of self. He thinks artists should find new ways to use time-honored techniques, while also being open to experimenting with emerging tools, including AI. The experience of being alive this century has changed dramatically, he said. We should engage with the times we live in, and then maybe we'd feel less hopeless about everything. What he really seems to be yearning for is a paradigm shift, some sort of formal leap forward combined with a spiritual reawakening. The culture we have is so obsessed with ourselves, with people's identities and personalities, he said. Perhaps we'll be able to transcend that somehow. Perhaps we will get over this deeply individualistic, deeply self-obsessed moment. He paused. But I don't know how that would happen. And we're about halfway through today's show, so let's take just a little break from this interesting piece about artwork and its current critics, and to remind everybody that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And if you want to go back and listen to this show from the top, or go back and listen to a few weeks from the past of the show, it's pretty easy. Just download that Sun Sounds of Arizona app on your tablet or on your phone. And from there, the top, when you first get into it, you can live stream the feeds, the Sun Sounds feeds from Tempe, from Flagstaff, from Tucson. And if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see all the shows that you can stream and download from that are broadcast on Sun Sounds, and many that we don't have time to put on the air. And this show, Points of View, you can find this show in the entertainment section. Okay, let's get back to this art piece. Isolation. KMUN-FM 91.9, a public radio station for the coastal town of Astoria, Oregon, broadcast from my 133-year-old Victorian cottage with burgundy caves and stained glass windows. One rainy day last spring, I was greeted there by the 41-year-old musician and writer Jamie Brooks, who wore a tweed jacket over a t-shirt and blazoned with the slogan, "Foresight Prevents Blindness." She introduced me to a variety of friendly station volunteers working in studios cluttered with stacks of vinyl records, spindles of CDs, and well-worn instruments and mixing boards. On one wall hung a hand-drawn map of the station's broadcasting area. It was a strikingly analog setting in which to meet an artist who once embodied the internet's futuristic potential. Best known for her work under the aliases Elite Gymnastics and Default Genders, Brooks has long been a bedroom musician, someone who uses a home computer to make high-quality recordings. In the early 2010s, as a 20-something, immersed in the hipster party scene in Minneapolis, Brooks collaborated with a friend to release a few ethereal dance songs that drew the acclaim of music bloggers. She was soon dating the similarly buzzy artist Grimes and living in Los Angeles, getting a close-up look at modern pop ecosystem. But these days, her mics and guitar are packed up in boxes, gathering dust. Spending time working on new songs just doesn't feel right, given her belief, articulated in a widely circulated tweets and essays, that the music industry is doomed. Like Giora, Brooks feels the tech and business interests are strangling the arts. Like Kissick, she believes that most of the new work that gets made today just flat out isn't good. But Brooks' view is even darker than either of theirs, and more explicitly personal. She described the future of music to me in one word: wreckage. Many musicians feel that Spotify's business model is predatory, forcing artists to participate in a system in which they make only a fraction of a penny whenever a song is played. Brooks agrees, but her concern runs deeper than the money itself. She argues that music's role in society has been corrupted. Streaming encourages artists to play an unnerving game of scale. The more songs they release, the more chance they have of going viral and turning pittances into real income. Artists are thus motivated to record as quickly and as cheaply as possible. All of this, Brooks believes, has led to a glut of music, both popular and obscure, that is plainly bad, less distinct, less soulful, and less skillfully made than the minimal standards of previous eras. Nobody can get resources to develop their craft, she said. The decline in quality has created the condition for what Brooks fears will come next, a flood of AI-generated songs that further devalue music as an art form and as an economic enterprise. Already, streaming platforms have encalculated a huge demand for utility music, such as white noise to fall asleep to and chill beats to study on. Cheap AI tools can now conjure credible versions of such music, and over time they'll only get better at imitating other styles. Listeners' standards have become so diminished that they won't be able to tell the difference. Brooks saw the early stages of this catastrophe unfolding during her time in Los Angeles. While we chatted, she casually mentioned being on the set at a Lady Gaga video shoot and watching Ezra Koenig of Vampire Weekend play songs in his backyard. But to hear her describe it, her LA years were mostly disillusioning. "I didn't really see a lot of success that I thought seemed desirable," she said. "It's like a lot of people sitting in rooms by themselves ordering fucking Uber Eats." What she meant is that the ethos of the bedroom musician, once an indie phenomenon, enabling outsiders to gain a foothold, quickly became the record industry default. Producers can skip the studio to work on their devices at home, commissioning instrumentalists and beat makers who live time zones away. Music is now widely made much in the matter of how it's consumed by people who are alone, encased in their headphones. This state of affairs, Brooks thinks, is antithetical to music's purpose. Listening to songs once meant getting a window into specific communal circumstances, into the churches where R&B evolved from gospel, into the block parties where hip-hop fermented, and into the clubs where rock bands jammed. Now most music is shaped and tailored to a fake place, an intangible scene, the internet. It only feeds the broader trends of cultural fracturing and personal solitude that are clearly depressing people's sense of well-being. I share the feeling that the mundanity of streaming has made music feel smaller, less important than it used to be. But I see plenty of signs that the art form still serves a social function. One of the biggest stories in the record industry in the 2020s has been the boom of country music, a style that's rooted in a sense of place and shared identity. New stars such as Zach Bryan and Lainey Wilson have been drawing droves not just to stream songs, but to sell out their tour dates and tailgate in the parking lot. New honky-tonks have been popping up across the nation, even in blue states. "There's still human culture that is being mined here," Brooks said when he got to talking about country music. She pointed out that Taylor Swift's success owes a lot to her having come up in Nashville, writing on guitar with seasoned songwriters, thus giving her skills that feel rarer with each passing year. But Brooks sees the country renaissance as a mere side effect of the genre being late to technological adoption, which isn't the same as defying it. "Streaming is taking longer to eat it," she said, "but streaming will destroy it." Eventual destruction is, in her view, the fate of most everything good about music and the broader artistic landscape. Gioria's boom and bust trend forecast, Kosick's pining for creative reinvention, both sound naive in Brooks' analysis. When people use this language, "Oh, it all moves in cycles. It's been going this way since time immemorial." "No, it hasn't," she said. Like in Joe Biden's lifetime, The sheet music industry was completely replaced by the record industry. And in our lifetime already, the practice of buying copies of records has been replaced by the concept of renting access to them. In other words, great things just don't change, they die. And what they've replaced with may well be worse, if they're replaced at all. As she wrote on Substack in 2023, the history of the record business is not a story about rejuvenating cycles of natural death and destined rebirth. It's a story of old, outmoded tech companies chasing diminishing returns. The path we're on is a spiral, not a circle, and it's getting smaller and narrower as we get close to the end. Hearing all of this made me particularly sad, because Brooke's own music always seemed like an example of how to defy modern alienation. She left Los Angeles in 2018, around the time that Grimes started dating Elon Musk, and recorded three excellent albums about searching for connection in a world made cold by technology, greed, and, to quote one lyric, crypto dipshits. The music was electronic, yet felt handcrafted, and Brooks, singing through a warbly vocal filter, sounded like a human trying to escape being turned into a machine. For now, though, Brooks has put her music career on hold. The process of moving notes around on a computer screen alone started to feel masturbatory. A successful new album would generate a bunch of value for Apple, for Spotify, for whatever other companies are taking pieces, she said. And I don't feel good about that. Now she's been spending her days hanging out at KMUN, learning about seemingly outmoded technology of terrestrial radio, which she thinks will gain a kind of post-apocalyptic usefulness to humanity as the internet is overrun with AI slop. Still, Brooks can't stop dreaming of new music she wants to make. She described one song idea that's been rattling around in her head lately. It's got horn solos, and it's got like Andrew Sisters backing vocals in the chorus. I suggested to her she might benefit from a new record deal to bring that vision to life. Well, no, Brooks replied. What she's lacking is collaborators, real-life bandmates, bonded by shared experiences, with physical instruments and the skills to use them. I need people. I need people who care. Acceleration. Each declinist I spoke with made a convincing case that large, inexorable forces were wearing culture down, but they also left me clinging to a scattered counterexamples that might tell another story. I've seen the omens of death. I need to make an effort to find signs of life, which is how I ended up swearing in a portly, ventilated indoor skate park in Brooklyn one summer night. I was there for a concert thrown by No Bells, a hip-hop-focused blog that bills itself as a hub for the wider internet underground. Young people sat on either side of a half-pipe, looking like members of a very eclectic tribunal. They wore jorts and crop tops or strappy S&M-influenced get-ups or pajamas emblazoned with cartoons. They fiddled with phones, lighters, Nintendo DS, and in one case, a unicycle at the bottom of the halfpipe, a mosh pit swirled around in a small stage. Two rappers shouted over a beat and paired incessant synthetic clapping with a sample of Somewhere Over the Rainbow played on the ukulele. Within the scrum of the stage was Kieran Press Reynolds, a 25-year-old journalist who seems like he should be a declinist but isn't. His father, the music critic Simon Reynolds, wrote the 2011 book Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past, which puzzled over the abundance of remixes, remakes, revivals in the 2000s, and made an early version of the stagnation argument now exposed by Gioria and many. Press Reynolds himself has made a budding career out of chronicling internet subcultures that seemed symptomatic of a society in crisis. When we met, he'd recently reported a story for the New York Times about a video game that satirizes online influencers by making players experience horrific things for content. For GQ, he delved into the looks-maxing community, young men who, among other techniques for optimizing their physical attractiveness, try to alter their faces by clenching their jaw for hours a day, egged on by internet forums that are, he wrote, cesspools of insecurities. And yet, Press Reynolds is energized by the culture right now. Maybe there isn't amazing macro trends at the moment, he told me, but if you scratch the surface on the mainstream, people are cooking. As a critic, he feels an obligation to spread the good news. Every young person deserves something to champion, he said. Something to really feverishly get excited about. Press Reynolds keeps his brown hair long and scraggly. His voice is hoarse and giddy. He described his own artistic obsessions in terms such as fried and anarchic. In music, on TikTok, and even in web design trends, he sees a turn towards an aesthetic he called Max Stimuli, and which pushes the bounds of speed, dissonance, and stillness while recombining bits of old culture into something new. It feels like how our brains feel right now, infested and congested with so much stuff, he said. He's particularly captivated by the hip-hop underground, a constellation of subgenres such as rage rap, which takes after the unintelligible lyrics and glitchy beats of the cult hero Playboi Carti, and PlugGNB, a woozy, melodic version of trap. A global community of producers swapping beats and software plug-in onlines is twisting hip-hop's conventions to create sound sculptures that Press Reynolds thinks really could not have come out of 10 years ago. He mentioned a recent SoundCloud micro-hit called Fragged Aft by an artist named Woke Ups. The song makes you think of a human expanding and deflating like an accordion, Press Reynolds said. I pulled up the track after we talked, a heavily filtered voice undulated about money and guns for 2 minutes over a swell of digital sound. The effect was weirdly beautiful. It gave me goosebumps. Other genres are getting scrambled in disorienting, playful ways. I've been fascinated by hyperbop-pop, a loose term for the punkish, noisy spin that bedroom electronic musicians put on bubblegum tropes. In 2024, hyperbop had its commercial breakthrough with Charlie XCX's album Brat, whose frenzied rhythms became popular enough to be adopted by the official memes of Kamala Harris' presidential campaign. Brooks had warned me not to put much stock in internet native music scenes. She dismissed most hyperpop as regurgitated video game soundtracks made by and for people who have never been to clubs. This has struck me as uncharitable, though in talking with Press Reynolds, I realized it wasn't entirely untrue. He traced his own teenage musical awakening to playing Minecraft while listening to hip-hop set to anime montages on YouTube. His culture critic parents, his mother is the writer of Joy Press, would play the slick beats of Daft Punk around the house, but he gravitated towards the blown-out distortion of angsty rappers such as XXXTentacion. When the pandemic lockdown came, he burrowed even deeper into the digital wilds. Being so online, Press Reynolds' joke, he had inflicted him with brain rot. He makes no apologies for being a music critic who almost can't hear to listen to full albums unless he'll just play a song for 30 seconds to feel that texture. This admission pained me a lot. I've felt my own attention span decaying in recent years, but I still cling to the idea that transcendent art and transcendent experience with art requires sustained focus. In many ways, the problems that Jura, Kissick, and Brooks spelled out were problems of terminally distracted audience preferring junk, recycled IP, political bait, wallpaper music, to quality. What are we going to do about brain rot? At the skate park concert, it occurred to me that art itself might be the answer. The headliner was a trio, the rappers Polo Perks and A.U. Lee, with the rapper-producer Fear Dorian, who hailed respectively from New York, Milwaukee, and Atlanta, but had linked up online and developed in-person friendship. Their songs deployed samples, emo rock, MIA, gaming music, with a kind of elegant dizziness, as if multiple browser tabs playing random audio were harmonizing together. A thwack on every eighth note, the signature beat of a recently ascendant Milwaukee rap scene created a sense of energizer bunny propulsion. Sweating at the bottom of the half pipe, pressed up against the crowd, I felt the music meet my own sense of distraction and supplant it. These artists had burst from the internet to convey feelings upon friendship, partying, and hustling, the classic hip-hop rush delivered with a sound that suits its times. The technologically induced isolation that Brooks worries about is also driving humanistic countermovements. The art of confessional songwriting is flourishing thanks to a wave of artists: Chapel Roan, Olivia Rodrigo, SZA, whose lyrical candor creates an intense sense of closeness between listener and artist. Together, these artists constitute an idea of pop that's anything but generic. Rather, it's witty, specific, and vulnerable. The leader of this class is, of course, Taylor Swift, who's been pioneering a futuristic form of storytelling. Every verse and every public utterance links together in an intricate wave of lore, which brings fans together for problem solving and puzzle solving and reinterpretation. Gurria, hardly the stereotype of a Swiftie, told me he's watched the concert film about her record-smashing Eras tour 3 times. I take some comfort in the fact that the biggest musical event of last year was Taylor Swift going on the road, playing real songs for real people in concert, Gurria said. AI may be able to imitate Swift's voice, but it can't forge social bonds like she can. A maximalist wave naturally favors the well-resourced, and an actual renaissance won't be possible until the economics of streaming are reformed or upended. Even so, indie artists are still releasing fantastical concept albums whose worlds spill out into music videos. TikToks, the other online channels, check out Magnalia Bay or underscores, and indie filmmakers are finding audiences for uncompromising visions. See the recent Oscars race between The Brutalist and Anora. Even seemingly brain-rotted content can sustain big ideas through inventive means. Internet comedians such as Psychonic uses costumes and visual filters to conjure bizarro characters that pop into social fields, creating long-form satire. When I'm locked in and enjoying such highlights of 2020's cultures, I'm grateful. Most of this work couldn't or wouldn't have existed before now. That doesn't mean I'm immune to the dread that plagues the declinist. They're really talking about forces deeper than culture, technological, political, economic, and social problems that required technological, political, economic, and social answers. The same YouGov survey that found the Americans to be so unhappy with the state of movies, TVs, and music found that people also generally feel that this is a decade with the worst economy, the least moral society, the least close-knit communities, and the most political division. What art can do is remind us that our lives are not simply shaped by systems. They're also a product of our own thoughts, inspirations, and relations. My favorite new show on this decade is HBO's Fantasmas, a comedy created by former Saturday Night Live writer Julio Torres. It's a magical, realist depiction of a near future in which people live with bumbling AI assistant bots in housing complexes owned by corporations such as the Bank of America. Torres' character wants to make surreal films about animals, but is being pressured to cash in on his own backstory as a gay immigrant. A streaming service run by Zappos, yes, the shoe company, commissions a screenplay called How I Came Out to My Abuela. This subject matters, asks quite darkly, whether the artistic spirit can survive in modern life. But the imaginative way the show is rendered, in a dreamscape of interconnected skits featuring handcrafted set decorations performed by talents from today's offbeat comedy world, offers a hopeful answer. Culture is not just a map of the structures and forces that order our society. It's what people make on top of it, in between, in opposition to, and in collaboration with these things. We all have the power to listen more curiously, look more closely, and treat the present with the same sense of generosity that we extend to our golden ages of the past. When you tune into the creativity that is still pulsing in these disorienting times, you can still hear the story that needs telling. Keep going. And that was The Day the Music Died. Is Popular Culture Really in Terminal Decline? By Spencer Kornhaber from the June 2025 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And that'll take us to the end of our show today. It's been a pleasure reading for you today. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and we will talk to you next week.